Accession number 9476, reel number 6.
Mr. Boone, reel 6. You were describing the population of Haydon and mentioned using the nunnery as a bathhouse. Could you tell me what the atmosphere was amongst the population? Were the Germans still advancing at this time?
No, the line was held firm. The population were in no form or state of panic. We were accepted because they wanted to help us, and they made available food in the form of chips and eggs. That's all they could give us, and coffee, which is a plentiful supply at a very, very normal sort of cost. The people were very friendly. Of course, I can't remember about the stamina age, but I think it was in the stamina in the village. They usually age, but I can't remember much about it. But I know one or two of the one of the farmhouses where there were some very attractive young ladies, and this attracted quite a lot of the elder men. We boys, you hardly believe it, we weren't a bit interested. And the parents looked after them, I can assure you, with a very watchful eye. And when I reflect upon it, I can understand their anxieties. It was quite nice at Haydon, we enjoyed it. The chateau was an enormous place. It had no architectural beauty at all. It was a long building, very long, and about two stories high. And I remember going up at the smallest hour of the morning with a telegram, a signal to the staff captain, and I was terrified. The moon was shining through the windows, and it was very weird, and I was scared to death about the place.
I'd just like to pick up on something you mentioned just now, which is the attitude of older men, presumably of your rank and maybe of other ranks, towards you as a boy. Could you perhaps expand a little more on the way that they treated and reacted towards you?
The older men, the one fairly well educated people, and the older men, they had a parental attitude, and kept their eye on us, and they knew the pitfalls of life which we weren't aware of. And when I look back now, I can see these fellows meant well. They were family men, and were treating us as members of the family. It was really a good family atmosphere. The elder men looked after us, kind to us, and helped us in many ways.
Can you give me any instances where they offered their advice or gave their advice?
I remember one of our boys was in difficulty. One of his parents had died, and this boy was grief stricken and he couldn't get leave, and one of the elder men consoled him and looked after him and talked to him quite seriously till he got over the shock. Oh yes, I remember that. I forget the boy's name now. We were only about well, I was 19 at the time, and we even had boys of 16. Would you believe it? 16. I remember Wolf Watson. He was just a little fellow. He was a cyclist, motorcyclist, and a tiny little fellow. He was just turned 16.
He was in your...
He was in our unit, part of our unit. He was a motor dispatch rider, and his job was to fly between the headquarters and the squadrons with... communications, written communications.
How was he treated by his fellows? I mean, even to you, surely as a 19-year-old, a 16-year-old must have seemed a very young person.
Well, he was very boyish, and so we were, so he fitted in very well. The elder men looked upon us more as members of a family, and they used to go drinking and smoking, and we had our own quiet ways of enjoying ourselves, the way boys do. I can't. We used to play snakes and ladders and simple games like that, just to fill the time in. And then, of course, we used to go along to the cafes and have coffee, sit and chat to the as best we can, crude in patois French. And we managed very well with the language as well, despite the fact none of us knew intricacies of the language at all.
Can you think of any instances where some of the older men actually gave you advice or tried to help you in some way?
The only thing I remember was that when we reported to our corporal about the demeanour and the behaviour of this interpreter, he became very interested and told us if we had any difficulties or of any time with anybody, he'd just come and see him and we'd talk it over. He's quite a fatherly sort of fellow, his old Corporal Wilson. As I say, he had been in the Navy, and he was a telegraphist, a post office telegraphist, and he was in charge of the signal office. Corporal.
Did you ever find their attitude towards you rather irksome at times? After all, you were 19 and growing up.
No. We didn't find it at all. Oh no, we were happy. We were just like a big happy family. We hadn't any restraints of any sort. The unit, the discipline was very lax. It wasn't regimental, and plus four. We all had a job to do, and we did the job. There was no marching, there was no drills, no nothing, no routine like that. Just more or less a clerical duty.
Well, I'd like to come back to that in a minute. But before we investigate that, can we perhaps look at your relationship with senior officers in the HQ?
Senior officers in HQ. We had no relationship with them at all. We weren't. They would pass you, and you had to salute them, of course, but they would barely recognise you. The higher, the officer grades, never in any way fraternised with, or didn't appear to me to take an interest in the stuff at all. And we were to listen and allowed to do what we want. Our colonel, you would go in with a message, a very important message as he was expecting. He would sit at his table, trestle table, he'd watch you come in, he'd watch you write up the report, and then as you left the desk to go out, he'd wait till you get to the door, and then you could hear him get up to come look at it. But he never spoke to you, never made a gesture of any sort at any time. But he was a most kindly man. Now, Colonel Newall, who became Air Marshal, eventually the Governor of New Zealand, he became a Baron. He was a great fellow. And when he was in the mess, it was like on the battleships. The officers of the very high ranks don't associate with the lower ranks of officers. And he kept himself very aloof.
At the time, did you in any way resent their relationship with the lower ranks?
No, not at all. We knew Newell was a kindly man. He adopted that attitude to everybody. And the officer class, as I say, they just ignored us. And we went about our business. As long as we did our job, they never interfered or criticised us or do anything, except the staff officer. He was a public school boy, very pucker, with he's always having different shades of putties and new forms of breeches, and very much the public school boy business. And I remember on one occasion he rang up on the phone. People usually turn the handle, but he used to just touch it. And the indicator used to give the merest flip, and it used to drop. And he expected you to jump in on quick. "I want to speak to General Trenchard," says he. So So I got through to the brigade headquarters, spoke to the operator, said, "May I be put through to General Trenchard?" She said, "Certainly. But who wants to speak to him?" I said, "The staff captain." He says, "Put the staff captain on the line." She says, "Telephone operators do not speak to generals." I rang the staff captain, told him he'd have to speak to the telephone operator, give details what he wanted, and he went through. And when the call was over, the staff officer came in and dressed me down for not putting me direct through to the general.
So you couldn't win either way?
Didn't matter what.
Well, how did you feel about this particular staff captain?
Well, I didn't care for him. He thought a great deal of his appearance. He came from a very wealthy family. He used to outshine all the others with his various shades of putties and his various tan boots and his various coloured pantaloon breeches. And it was obvious he had quite a lot of money. And I understand his family very, very high indeed in the London society.
You mentioned public schoolboys as a sort of group of people. How did you feel about the officers who presumably many of them would be public schoolboys? Did you feel any resentment at all towards their privilege?
Oh, no, not at all. We hadn't much to do with the officers, really. No, we didn't. Now, you see, the public school element was very strong. And one of our staff captains, varied, of course, during the period, from Manchester. He was a PhD, but he wasn't public school. Another staff officer later on, he was a graduate of Edinburgh. He didn't fit in with the public school idea. And these men were, I'm not saying they were ostracised, but they were treated with reserve.
Yes, that's interesting. You said the public school idea. What do you mean by that?
Well, you have various public schools, Harrow, Eton and that, and there seemed to be an association of the fact that one belonged to one type of school, another one belonged to the same kind. It was a unit that linked them. It was a unit, provided a unity. It provided a common ground for them. Here were strangers meeting who had the same background. I think that's what it was.
Did you see any evidence of snobbery? I mean, you tend to suggest that might have been a snobbery between the, although people had been well educated, they hadn't come from the same class. Would you say there was any snobbery attached to?
For instance, I have only one one non-commissioned officer being a pilot, or I forget what it was, a pilot or whatever. But every pilot and observer, without exception, was of an officer's grade. As I say, we had only one fellow was a sergeant. And this man, by the way, eventually became a commander of, he became Major McCudman. He became commander of a squadron. But it was the only case. All the rest were officer grades. And they had this public school complex, which suited the particular way of life. I remember on one, I think it was 66 squadron, I'm not sure, and we had the pilot on this plane who was an officer grade, and the observer was a flight sergeant. And as soon as they got on the plane, they used to converse. And then when they came back, that ceased. As soon as they got out of the plane, they climbed out of the plane, one turned left and the other turned right, and they never saw or spoke to himself So the whole of the day, just when they were flying, they kept that clear distinction between ranks.
Did you actually see that incident where the pilot got out?
No, no. You see, the boys used to talk, and they used to see things, and then when they got into the mess, they used to swap the yarns of the experiences. And the dispatch riders who used to go to the squadrons, they used to get all the local tittle-tattle, and when they came back to the headquarters, they used to tell us what they'd heard. And it was just like village life. Just the usual gossiping.
Can you give me any examples of the sort of gossiping that they that they passed on?
I can't remember anything in particular. I will have mentioned it if it comes to mind. I remember one or two occasions. You see, in those days, the planes, the propeller had to be swung by physically. There was no starting gear. And you have one man who gets a hold of the blade of propeller with two hands, and another man who's got his hand round his waist. And as the man pulls down on the blade of the propeller, his mate pulls him away out of the road. And on one or two occasions, they weren't quick enough, and the poor men lost their arms. And sometimes the blades, I don't know what used to happen, sometimes used to dip, and propellers was two bladed, made of mahogany, and if there was a breakage of any sort, I had cast to one side, and we used to collect these and saw the tip off the good end, and turn it into a picture frame. You have the tip of the propeller, and you cut an oval in with a jackknife. So spend the evening, or perhaps a few nights, cutting this out. It was one way of filling the time in. Yeah. And another thing, of course, we do pass the time was to collect. Sometimes we went onto a battlefield where the troops had advanced, and we could pick up shell cases and cartridge cases, and the cartridge cases we used to turn into paper knives, and shell cases we used to cut up and make into ashtrays and things like that.
Returning just for a moment to the relationship between the ranks, what opinion did you have of your very senior staff, perhaps people that you didn't ever meet, but the generals and so on who were conducting the war?
Well, General Trenchard was a very impressive fellow, but he was generally his presence was more apparent than his general demeanour. It was known that he had some very good aides. I think if you know, as a historian, Napoleon depended entirely or greatly upon his generals, and Trenchard was like that. He had a good idea of his own importance, and he carried the way with him.
Did you feel that at the time?
No, I didn't. You see, I had very little contact with the headquarters people. I happened to know the telephone operator very well because he came from the north, Cocky Gardner, that was his name, and that just about his nickname just about indicated what kind of fellow he was. But we have had very little contact or conversation ever with an officer.
Okay, finally, I would just like to ask you, religion played any great part in your life during the war as a means of support during the time
no,
you were away from
home? I can't say it did. I remember when we were at Halton Camp, there was the various groups, there was the nonconformists, there was the high church, and there was the Catholic religions. And you'd find in the army, everybody went where the food was. The denomination didn't matter. And we found that the Catholic, if you went to the Catholic Church, you got a good feed. And we were all looked after. And consequently, the church parade on the Catholic side was very strong. I remember going along with the boys. And I was brought up as a nonconformist, but it never played a dominant part in my life as a youngster.
This was whilst you were at the camp in Britain, was it? You're describing what happened at the camp in Britain.
Oh, yes, that was in Britain. But in France, I can't remember anything on the religious line, except I remember there was Hanley Page came in. And
this is an aircraft you're talking about now?
Yeah, Hanley Page aircraft, which was quite an unusual thing, because it was the biggest plane existing at the time. And the chaplain, it so happened, had been a curate at the school where I was a child, and here was this Church of England chaplain in front of me as a young man, and he was delivered the sermon. I remember that Canon Milner. That was it.
Did he come in on the aeroplane?
I don't know if he came in on the aeroplane. I think he did. And they used the aeroplane cockpit as a pulpit. Oh, yeah.
Because that must have been very high up above the ground.
Yeah, I remember that. Otherwise, no. No religious aspect whatsoever. Not the slightest.
Were there many people amongst your unit that used religion as a...
I saw no evidence of it. No.
Did you have any church parades at all?
No. You see, in the infantry, you had to you lined up and you had to be well dressed and you should march and everything and go on to church parade. But there was nothing of that at all. We never. I have no recollection of any unit at any time ever being attending a church parade.
Right, thank you. I'd like to turn now to some aspects of the work done at the wing headquarters. You've mentioned the signallers and wireless operators in passing, but not photographic and intelligence work, which took place there. Did you come across any of that work being done whilst you were there?
Oh, yes. Yeah. We had a photographic unit. The personnel, 3. Believe it or not, the highest rank was a flight sergeant. Next, he had a corporal, and then he had an ordinary rating. 3 men. And these men used to accept... We had, take for instance, 27 Squadron. 27 Squadron, Martin Sides, 2-seaters, out on reconnaissance, come back, and all the plates... Plates, taken to the photographic section in a hut, and they were conditioned and examined, and if there's anything untoward noticed in this casual thing, it was handed to a higher officer, and it was then determined if there was anything on the plate of military value, movements of troops, disposition of aeroplanes, mission dumps, the numbers of trains on the move, the transport on the roads, and which way it was moving, and was it a continuous stream or just an odd one, and that's the kind of thing they went in for, and if they saw a large convoy of lorries, of course, this used to attract attention because it more or less indicated there was some movement towards perhaps an offensive.
How was this information that they found sent out? Did that go through? Did that go over the phone, or what?
All this information, so far as I remember. Oh no, No, no. We had these dispatch riders, and everything was carried by dispatch riders. The telephone communication wasn't particularly good. You couldn't bring up, shall we say, I want to speak to so-and-so. You first of all find if so-and-so was connected. And if he wasn't, well, you had to send a dispatch rider.
Would they have sent that information? Would they have sent that information over the telephone in any case?
I don't think so, no. There wasn't much eavesdropping, not to my knowledge. There weren't the facilities, and they hadn't the technique in those days. Except in the front lines, you could get overhearing by induction. But we're not a great distance apart. That inductive effect was minimised. No, you didn't get it.
Yeah, can you explain what you mean by induction?
Well, I mean, if you get two electrical conductors in a certain proximity, someone's talking on circuit A, and if circuit B is parallel with it, you can overhear, providing A and B are alongside one another for a long distance, you can overhear one another. Now, that was a problem in the early days of telephony. They had long stretches of lines where wires were parallel all the way, and they were having overhearing between one set and another, and they couldn't understand it. They changed the insulators, they changed everything, and then they suddenly discovered it was induction, and by what they call transposition, the wires worked on a corkscrew.
They were twisted, you mean, down the line?
Twisted as well. They called it the twist. It was a corkscrew fashion.
And that stopped the effect of induction?
Stopped induction completely. You see, they changed position. On pole number one, position was top left. And on pole number five, it was top left again. And so on.
Right, thank you. Turning now to wireless. You mentioned that you had wireless operators, I think two. You said.
We had two wireless operators. They were operators in the sense that they received wireless or listened to it. The equipment was primitive in the extreme. You can't find anything more primitive. It consisted of a cardboard drum, a cylinder, about 9 inches diameter, about 18 inches long, with a metal square inch, quarter inch square at the top, with a slider knob and a crystal and a pair of headphones. And not what the way Ninth Wing had. Primitive.
And what were they listening to?
We had two men who used to alternate between night and day duty. A corporal banter and first class air mechanic William Nash, and they used to have 12 hour shifts, and during that time the Germans used to broadcast on a regular routine, and they used to take it down. It was Morse. These men didn't understand German. They just took it down Morse code.
During the war, was that equipment ever modified? Did it stay like that right away to the end?
We never had wireless as we understand it today until towards the end, and we had one 2-valve set, and you had to have a very, very long area for that, and we had a pole about 20 foot high, and we strung the aerial from it, and from the top of that pole at night we had a red hurricane lamp.
Yeah.
In case there was any spare aircraft about, but it was primitive in the extreme. Just a 2-valve receiving set, no transmission.
And finally, one of the things you've mentioned a couple of times, and we haven't really explored yet, is the